Thanks for listening to We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson uprising. If you like what you hear, we have more great content on our website, stlpr.org. While you're there, you can catch up on the news and listen to more podcasts like The Gateway, Politically Speaking, and St. Louis on the Air. We also have music. Listen to our classical and jazz streams along with archived episodes of the next set from Jazz St. Louis at stlpr.org.
Good morning, Tyler.
Hey, good morning, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm grateful. How are you, Chad?
I want you to describe the idea or the process of finding a school. If you could describe it in one word, what would it be and why?
Overwhelming. Thinking about all the things that I have to have in order to do it. Sometimes not understanding the jargon and the language, but the more honest I am, sometimes the more it hurts me because it can be expensive sometimes. And although it might look like we have it, once we put it into that, we don't, and it just causes more stress.
That was Tyler Smalls. He's a parent from St. Louis and a dad of a 4-year-old. I also spoke with Brian Owens, who lives in Ferguson. He has 8 kids, and when I asked him the same question, well, it wasn't that easy for him.
You want that in one word? Like, bro, you don't have to describe your view on finding proper education for your children in one word. For us, I would say freedom.
Mm.
And I think that early on, my wife and I made a decision to exercise our freedom.
I even called up my dad to ask him the same thing. And like Brian, he couldn't answer it with just one word. But he did describe a lengthy process where he and my mom weighed a bunch of factors.
We were just looking for a home that was centrally located. You know, we didn't have any kids at the time, but we said, hey, you know, if we do start having children, you know, we're in a good school district, and we're looking for a good school that you didn't have to pay, you know, it was taxpayer funded. You know, we didn't have to pay any money. I was always under the impression, too, that even if we were in a so quote-unquote good school district, if you know you weren't being treated fairly and we felt it was a racial issue or whatever the case would be, we were going to take you out and we're going to go to the private schools.
Our conversation started to shift and my dad started talking about stories from when he was a kid, when he was bused to a nearby school in the 1960s and 70s, and the school that was right next to that.
I remember the first day we were bused over there, the thing that I noticed that at the predominantly black school where we were, and the schoolyard, it was so many kids there. The schoolyard was just crowded at recess time. It was just very crowded situation. And I think that's the reason why they decided to build another school, which was Yateman. I'll even name it. They decided to build Yateman. And that was the impetus to where this desegregation case came from.
A couple years later, in the early 1970s, a black mother named Minnie Liddell had a son at Yateman. At first, the school was a dream come true, but like many other SLPS schools, it too became overcrowded, and the district said her son had to get transferred to another school that was run down and condemned. So, she and other parents sued the St. Louis Board of Education, arguing the policy was unconstitutional and that black kids were being enrolled in poor schools. The case eventually led to the Voluntary Interdistrict Choice Corporation, a program where county schools accepted black students from the city and county students were transferred to the city's magnet schools if they wanted. The ruling changed St. Louis, allowing black families to send children to districts across the region. The legal mandate sought to reverse decades of forced segregation, and it worked to an extent. At its peak, more than 14,000 students were transferred to county and city schools. But by the end of the 90s, districts started pulling out of the program for various reasons. The program, which was always intended to be temporary, started phasing out, and this past school year was the last year the program accepted new students. Now, school segregation is higher than it was 30 years ago. the conversation surrounding education changed after the Ferguson Uprising. Commissions formed, reports were released, and even regional studies became, for a short time, more than just a dream. 10 years later, that dream has been deferred so many times, it feels like a nightmare. Some parents don't even believe in desegregation anymore. When I was a kid, if you had asked me how to fix school, I could have solved it in a heartbeat. We're getting hot dogs for lunch every day, SpongeBob seasons 1 through 3 playing in every classroom, that's very important, Flavor Ice popsicles, and oh, those Valentine's Day boxes where you'd put notes in those shoebox mailboxes. Yeah, that would do it. Surprisingly though, it's much more complicated than that. It's so much harder, of course, than one word can contain. Though I'm not a kid anymore, and not a parent, I'm still curious. In St. Louis, you don't really get to choose your school. Race chooses it. Place chooses it. Those with the means, with money, have more options. They can leave their communities or join ones elsewhere. Those without those means stay and put up with it or fight to change it. Many black kids went to North County for quote-unquote good schools. But after a while, the districts there started facing their own issues. White flight, decaying property values, and consolidations. So some try to find new schools even further out of the city or the county, only to come face to face with people trying to prevent black history from being taught. Those are the issues many black parents face today, and we're gonna walk through some of those. So let's get back on that bus. This is We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson Uprising. If everything played out for Tevin Rice based on where he lived, he would have gone to an SLPS school. But because of busing, he went from the city out west to the Parkway School District. He went to a majority white school from 1996 to 2001. And while he says he got a great education, it wasn't without its trade-offs, including feeling like an outsider among classmates.
I grew up in the desegregation program, which is a very unique experience. I mean, on one hand, it exposed me to all the diverse environments and it offered a lot of educational opportunities that wasn't really available in my neighborhood. But it wasn't without its challenges. There were many instances where I kind of felt like I was an outsider and like dealing with the subtle and overt biases from both like my peers and actually educators as well too. I just felt isolated even from the bus. They pick us up in a little small, short bus that's like, you know, like, it's just it's like, the other buses don't look like this. Why does my bus look like that? And it just, from my experience and being inside the school, I just really felt like that this wasn't my school, that I was borrowing somebody else's education.
Black people weren't just hopping on the bus for better schools. Many, of course, also moved to those areas. Some districts even merged, leading to integrated districts. And some parents realized those options just weren't for them.
One day, my middle son, Kashawn, I took him to school. It was within the first week of school. And I remember walking him to class, and I remember hearing the teacher talking to the children like drill sergeant.
That's Okunshola Amadu, the founder of Jama Birth Village, a midwifery in Ferguson. She's also a mother to 3 kids, and she's spent a lot of time trying to navigate the school system.
And she was, come in, put your bag down, sit down, don't talk, sit on your hands, you know, da-da-da-da. It was like, no, good morning, how are you, excited to see you today. It was so depressing.
Okunshola wasn't mad at the teacher. She understood how low teacher pay and limited resources could have led to this interaction. But it did push her to reconsider where her children would go to school. She spoke with the principal and asked if they could move her son to another classroom. School leaders objected, so she made the choices that worked best for her and her family.
So I asked them to just move him to another school. They refused. So I chose to homeschool my son. And I homeschooled him until I got them to agree to move his classroom, and they did.
It was a learning experience for Okunshola. And while she didn't like the experience her son faced, she was willing to try again with her younger son. But that didn't last long.
I tried to take him back to the elementary school. He lasted 1 day. And I said no. So I homeschooled him and I put him in a private school.
And that private school wasn't close. She lives in Cool Valley right next to Ferguson. Her son's private school was in Webster Groves, about 13 miles away.
I felt guilty because the private school was predominantly white, and I felt like I was voluntarily putting my child in a DSEG program. But I had to choose. So that has been a struggle. I could not afford to pay private school. I was late a lot. I had to apply for financial aid and scholarships, and I had to pay gas to drive all the way to Webster Groves from Ferguson every day back and forth. But it was, you know, I did the best that I could.
Okunshola temporarily moved from the Ferguson area to South Grand to live near her kids' schools. That led to even more problems for her and her kids.
So the campus would get shut down because of gunfire. Oftentimes, things would be stolen from him. So even between, do you go to public school and deal with that? Do I homeschool and then not be able to focus on my studies? Do I send him to a mostly all-white private school and compromise his blackness and his self-esteem? Or do I send him to a private school that has a blend, but then I have to deal with violence and my child getting bullied or getting into fights? It's a struggle in St. Louis, either way, unless you have a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of resources.
She realized the area near Ferguson that she lived in just didn't fit her needs, especially when one of her sons was moved from one elementary school to another after a closure. She saw how other parents were struggling. She saw the effects of overcrowding and fewer resources dedicated to their kids.
So where do those children go? And now how are the classrooms overcrowded? And how is that going to impact and give them an equitable chance at the best education and to feel happy and cared for and identified?
These issues plague many North County schools. Districts like the Normandy Schools Collaborative and Riverview Gardens have lost accreditation at different points in time. White flight has impacted property values, and some black families are leaving.
Part of the reason that these places are closing, especially in the city, is a change in demographics. With the change in demographics, the loss of housing, with the loss of housing, you get the loss of taxes from houses. Are from residents, residential taxes, which support the schools.
That's Jacqueline Lewis Harris, a Ferguson resident who saw the writing on the wall 30 years ago. She saw that there were real challenges coming to Ferguson and the surrounding areas. She and other Ferguson residents banded together to improve community investment in the area, boosting home ownership efforts, and encouraging people to vote in school board elections. But what if you're like Okunshola and decide what's best for your kids is to leave that school and find a new one? Well, a lot of families moved to other districts, but some of those schools were facing their own set of problems. We'll be back after the break. And we're back. In the seemingly never-ending search for a good school, some parents decide to transfer their kids to a better district. That's what some parents from the predominantly black Normandy Schools Collaborative sought to do in 2013 when a state Supreme Court ruled that students from the district could transfer to nearby districts, including the predominantly white Francis Howell in neighboring St. Charles County. And hey, remember when we talked about white flight earlier? Well, as black families left the city for North County over the last 50 years, many white families then moved from North County to St. Charles County. That context was in the background at public forums where some white Francis Howell parents pushed back against the plan.
Students that have learning problems or that are a little under more than A students, but how are you going to do that when you don't even know until the day school starts? The students that have tried so very hard in this school district to keep the accreditation going, once Normandy comes in here, will that lower our accreditation? Also, if the students that come from Normandy, if they decide it doesn't work here, do we as a school district have to pay back that tuition?
This was 2013 at Francis Howell. After Normandy Schools Collaborative lost its accreditation, a state Supreme Court ruled that students from the district could be bused to nearby districts, including Francis Howell, a predominantly white district. Most of those students from Normandy were Black. There was a lot of rage at the time. Francis Howell parents were upset, worried that Normandy students joining their kids would drag the district down. Now, that was 11 years ago. If you started kindergarten then, you'd be an upperclassman high school student. So water under the bridge, right? Well, not quite. Because the last couple of years, the district school board has faced another reckoning that has troubled many Black parents in the district.
My mom, sitting right over there, and lives here now, along with her siblings, were part of integrating the public schools west of 63rd Street on the south side of Chicago in the 50s. They were chased home every day. I'm here to put a face and a voice to the fact that we are Black history.
Over the past year, the district school board has passed efforts to remove and revamp its Black history and literature courses and remove its social justice standards. I was at some of these meetings. The energy was tense, palpable. You saw fear from Black parents, allies, and teachers worried that their kids weren't learning in a safe environment. You also heard the anger from some white parents arguing that their kids were being indoctrinated. That anger is just one example of a growing backlash against school boards across the country in which some are trying to change how Black history is taught, whether it's by changing what's taught in class or by banning books. But the writing was on the wall, and Heather Fleming, who moved to the district with her three kids, remembers it. She also understands that parenting while Black is often a gamble.
Black parenting, in a lot of ways, is choose your own adventure. As a Black parent, when I have to think through decisions for my child, the decisions that I make for my child, there are so many levels that I really have to literally say, which problems am I willing and equipped to deal with and to handle? And so, first of all, for a lot of parents, even the ability to be able to make a choice about where to move is a privilege. But if you have that privilege, then you have to think in terms of, do I select a district that is possibly underfunded, under-resourced, understaffed, but have Black teachers, Black administrators, and individuals that have been educated in racialized issues that might impact my child's education? Or do I go to a school district where they're going to have to deal with a lot more in terms of racialized harassment, teachers and educators that may not be as well versed in navigating these issues, et cetera? For me, having grown up in St. Charles myself, I graduated from St. Charles West, I understand that when you choose to put your children in predominantly white suburban schools, that there's still an added layer of vigilance that you have to add.
The busing fiasco was just a year before Mike Brown was killed.
You saw some of these themes really being carried forward as far as the discussions that people were having around race and ethnicity and equity. And so there was a lot of learning that needed to be done.
At the time, Heather was an English teacher at another district. And crazy enough, she was actually taking a diversity and inclusion course. During one of those sessions, people asked her how she felt about the shooting. And it didn't go well.
It went so horribly wrong. And what I started realizing is that there were a lot of people that, no matter how earnest they were in trying to do race equity work, they just didn't have the skills to engage in it. And so I started creating training sessions for teachers to be able to learn. It was a misnomer. I called it Courageous Conversations, but it was actually like, here's the work that you have to do before you even begin to engage in these conversations.
That was in 2014. But let's fast forward about 6 years to 2020, after George Floyd was murdered. There were protests in St. Charles County near the Francis Howell District. People called for police accountability and an end to racial profiling. And it wasn't just Black parents protesting. You had people of all kinds of backgrounds outside. And the school board was different then. Its members approved an anti-racist resolution, pledging to treat all students equally regardless of race. Parents like Heather were more than pleased. It felt like after Mike Brown or the racial reckoning of 2020, people were listening to her and other Black parents.
And what that board identified was that a lot of our students and community members were hurting. And that hurt came not simply from, it was just like, you know, what I said with Mike Brown. When you're able to sit and identify yourself, your family, your experience within the experience of this man who died such a horrible death, of Breonna Taylor who died such a senseless death. It was hard in certain ways because on top of that, we have this global pandemic that had started. And so people were isolated, they were in a bubble, but we saw the heat turn up online in parent groups, and the rhetoric became even more toxic.
That's when the backlash kicked in, just a couple years after the resolution. The makeup of the school board changed, then it changed again. And before you knew it, only two people who had approved the anti-racist resolution remained on that board. The others opposed it and made efforts to change that and other policies. They pulled the anti-racist resolution last year. Heather saw what was happening as an attack on herself, her kids, and other Black kids in the Francis Howell District. She saw this happening in other nearby districts too. Now, she pushes for diversity efforts in education and school boards across Missouri. But the temperature is still high at Francis Howell, especially after the board voted to pull the Black history and literature courses in favor of more politically neutral ones. Many parents and students were worried that the classes wouldn't return at all. And while they were relieved to see the classes on the course list, they said there wasn't a reason to change the classes in the first place.
And so to say that we're going to teach our history from a political perspective means that you're not going to teach our history. You know, right now we have a law that they keep reintroducing that would say, hey, you can't discriminate against me for the way that my hair grows from my head. What they're trying to do is to limit access to information by the community. And that is shameful. It's anti-democratic. What we say that we value is a democracy. It also is anti-education. Because, and I'll never forget, people started being like, you're trying to indoctrinate kids with left-wing, da-da-da. No. The definition of indoctrination is that you present one idea and you expect people to accept that idea uncritically. When I present in my classroom several different ideals, I am doing the opposite of indoctrinating students. And just because it's an idea that you don't like, there's lots of ideas that I don't like. But that doesn't mean that I want my child to not have any exposure whatsoever, because in the end, my hope and my dream and what I think a lot of parents in Francis Howell want for their children is we want kids that can become good citizens. And the way they become good citizens is by being exposed to ideas and to be able to think through those ideas clearly, to be able to think through those ideas intelligently.
In April of 2024, a group of about 30 or more concerned community members met for the first time at Francis Howell Central High School Library. The group isn't affiliated with the district and includes parents and educators from across the St. Louis area. For the most part, they have some relationship with Francis Howell, whether it be kids in the district or living nearby. The group formed this year to offer a safe place for conversations about race, identity, and ethnicity. Parents and community members are encouraged to attend these meetings to have productive conversations about race, even if they differ from one another.
But for us as a community to grow and to thrive, we have to figure out how to begin to listen and learn from each other.
That's Miranda Bell, a Black Francis Howell parent and Ferguson Florissant teacher who is also leading the group.
A couple of months ago, I got the chance to just have a quick conversation with some friends who are what we would say on the other side, and they will never understand my journey. I will never understand their fear, but we do have to survive and thrive together in this community.
Students have taken the lead too, including Lauren Chance, a recent Francis Howell graduate who took Black History in 2023. The following year, she and three others led a protest at one of the three high schools where the courses would change. She was vocal, passionate, and made it clear that she wouldn't back down.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
That was my first time in high school after COVID, and it really opened my eyes, and it was a great community for me. And to hear it being ripped away from me was honestly the most disappointing thing I've heard from the school so far.
When I spoke with Lauren soon after the protest, she shared something that stood out to me.
It's really opened me up to being a critical thinker, being able to think for myself and formulate opinions for myself. I also think the class built a lot of confidence.
It ties into some of the points parents shared with me about identity and seeing yourself, about being comfortable with who you are and how schools are often the vehicle for that. Generations of Black, Brown, immigrant families, and more have tried all their lives to move into a neighborhood or a district where they feel safe, go to a quote-unquote good school, and feel seen. It's what everyone in this episode wants for their kids. Can you imagine moving, removing, spending money on a private school, or paying higher taxes for a good public school just for people to say, "We don't think your history is valuable? We don't want your perspective?" That's what Lauren was talking about. And that's what all of these parents are trying to prevent. When Mike Brown was killed, it put a spotlight on inequities in all facets of America, including education. And 10 years later, it looks like things have changed, but not in the direction many people may have hoped. But for every backlash, there's a push for progress. And for people like Lauren, Heather, Okunshola, Tevin, Brian, and Tyler, they're leading that. Whether it's doing whatever they can to make sure themselves or their kids are in a good school, whether it's by moving to a better district for a better opportunity, or by fighting where they are. I'm Chad Davis. This is We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson Uprising.
This episode was produced by Chad Davis and edited by Emily Woodbury.
With production assistance from Aula Kuziz and audio mixing and podcast design by Greg Montanil.
We received editorial guidance from Brian Heffernan. Chris Husted is our executive producer.
Special thanks to Camille Stanley, Danny Wisentowski, and Kate Grumke.
Our theme music was inspired by Cassie Morgan and remixed by Mastermind. We Live Here is a production of St. Louis Public Radio in collaboration with the Midwest Newsroom. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Enjoying this season of We Live Here? Suggest us to a friend you think might like the podcast and leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help new people discover the show. And thanks.